And we're going to do the work session work first, if that's okay. Because there's some nice people that are going to show up for these public hearing bills that aren't here yet. You want me to, which one do you want me to start? This one right here?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2460. Teresa, you want to explain what we're doing here?
Certainly. House Bill 2460 is brought to you, committee members, on behalf, actually from three members of the committee, Representative Rosenbaum, you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Fulvey. We had our first hearing on February the 12th. House Bill 2460 excludes leave taken by an employee who is unable to work because of a disabling compensable injury from the definition of family leave in workers' compensation law. The measure also establishes that when a covered covered employee may not reduce the amount of an employee's available family leave when they are unable to work because of the injury.
Is anyone signed up? Public hearing today. Is anyone signed up? Ms. Trussell, would you like to come testify, please? Thank you very much.
In work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and I'm here today to voice concerns about House Bill 2460. And I'm sorry I was unable to attend the hearing you had last week. I had another conflict. But before I turn it over to Randy Sutton to talk in more detail about the bill, I just wanted to point out to members that one of the most administratively burdensome regulations on HR departments deals with Oregon Family Leave Act and then the Federal Medical Leave Act and the disparity sometimes or discrepancies between the two, which become a bookkeeping nightmare. And House Bill 2460 would create one more disconnect between the federal law and the state law. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Sutton and then be happy to answer questions after he testifies.
Thank you. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, committee. I'm a partner with the Saufell Griggs Law Firm here in Salem, Oregon. My practice focuses on employment law. I've also been involved with the Society for Human Resource Management for a number of years. That's a nationwide organization. They have about 200,000 members. They're all HR people. It's kind of a politically free organization. They're looking out for the interests of the workplace, and they have over 1,000 members here in Oregon. So I'm here representing them, and I'm also a member of AOI, and I'm here to help AOI out. And my name is Randy Sutton, if I didn't already say that. Workers' Compensation and Oregon Family Leave Act, essentially they're achieving the same purpose. They both are covering serious health conditions. One is a disabling injury that happens at work. That's going to be your workers' compensation disabling injury. And family leave covers serious health conditions, which include incapacities because of a medical condition. It makes you unable to work. So they keep the same essential purpose, but the family leave law requires that the employer hold the person's job open, and a lot of times the employer has to continue paying benefits for that employee because they have to reinstate that employee's benefits in full upon the employee's return. So essentially they're achieving the two same purposes. The problem is that the companies don't staff for absences, they staff to get the work done, and when a person is gone for an extended period of time, the other employees either carry the burden or they have to hire a temporary employee who's just not trained for the job. The disconnect that this bill creates is going to have an effect of basically doubling the family leave entitlement for certain employees, but not others, and it really creates an unfair and kind of illogical situation. I'll give you an example. Suppose that an employee is working at home, they're lifting some lumber, and they hurt their back. They're not going to be eligible for workers' compensation. That's going to be a family leave type disability. Suppose the exact same thing. They're at work, and they're lifting that same amount of lumber, and they hurt their back. They're going to be eligible for workers' compensation coverage. Suppose a doctor says that you can't come back to work for 14 weeks, employee. Well, the employee that hurts their back at home, family leave is going to expire in 12 weeks, so they're going to burn through their family leave. They won't necessarily even be entitled to return to work because their family leave benefits are now exhausted. And that's the intent of the law, and that's what the legislature decided when it enacted the Oregon version of the family leave law, and the federalists done the same thing. Compare that now if we have the new bill and the employee injures exact same injury at work, what's going to happen is that employee is going to be gone for 14 weeks. That's okay under the workers' comp system. The employee comes back, and suppose now the employee has another reason they need to be gone. Suppose the mom is sick or whatever the reason might be. They can now use their entire allotment of 12 weeks of leave right after they come back from this extended absence. That's doubling the leave for that employee, and it makes no sense to give that employee who has the exact same injury more leave time than the person who injured themselves in the exact same way at home. So that's the problem with the disconnect. The other thing, if you guys don't want to bore you with a kind of a refresher course in family leave laws, but this area of the law is called the Bermuda Triangle, and it's because of the complexity, and I give a lot of seminars on Bermuda Triangle issues. The Bermuda Triangle is the workers' compensation, disability law, and family leave law kind of trifecta here. Under family leave law, you have Oregon and federal law. Under disability, you have Oregon and federal law. And then you have workers' compensation law. And the HR managers are just trying to figure this out, trying to wade their way through it. And it's very, very complex, very difficult. This bill just creates another disconnect where under family leave law, under the federal law, they can still track this concurrently, but under Oregon law, they won't be able to. So we have yet again another layer of complexity for the HR managers. So I think this is a bill that there's not really an ill that I'm seeing that it's needing to cure. I think it's going to add a lot of complexity, and frankly, it's going to add some very unfair results depending on when a person's injured, when and where a person's injured. I'll take any questions at this point.
Representative Escobar?
Yes, does not this law, the way this is written in here, does it not just apply to workman's compensation, workman's on-the-job injury?
It does. Essentially what happens, normally the workers' comp injury will be tracked the exact same way as the family leave law. If the two injuries both qualify under the separate laws, the way the HR managers throughout the country deal with this is they say, okay, if this is an injury that qualifies for family leave and it's a workers' compensation injury, we're going to run these leaves concurrently. This disconnects that and kind of layers, instead of running concurrently, is stacking them up. So that's what the effect is.
Well,
yes, sir.
Well, then let me ask this question. If you were working for someone, you were hurt on the job, you were receiving compensation for that through workman's comp, do you think that that should deteriorate your family leave?
It's achieving the same purpose. The purpose of family leave laws is to keep a person's job there for them so that they can return when they come back from an injury. Workers' compensation does that very well. There's reinstatement rights under workers' comp. The two laws have the exact same goal, and really what we're doing is we're doubling up on the family leave rights when we don't need to, because workers' comp already fulfills the same goal, which is let's get the employee back to work when the employee is healthy again.
Yes, sir.
Then I have another question. I'm a worker. I work for someone. I get hurt on the job. I'm receiving my workman's comp, and then I come back, and a couple months later, I need family leave. Is it my fault that I was injured on the job, so I lose that family leave in order to be with my family at a time that they need me? I guess that's the question.
Yeah, family leave laws, the goal behind them is a very good goal, and a lot of employers give a lot more leave than family leave even requires. I have a lot of employers who are not, my clients, that are not covered by the leave laws, but they're able to give employees extra leave just as kind of a good HR practice. The issue is requiring employers to do this when sometimes they're not able to. The family leave laws in the situation of the employee pulling the lumber at home and hurting their back, the law only allows 12 weeks, and that's all the law requires an employer to provide. So if the employee happens to need additional leave, that's one of the decisions that's made a long time ago about how much leave is too much leave for an employer to be required to give. So it's a little bit unfair for the employee, but it's very consistent with both nationwide and Oregon practice.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, also with workers' comp, and I know Representative Rosenbaum is very familiar with that subject because she sat on IMLAC for many years, there is reinstatement rights under workers' comp for, I think, up to 3 years. And then there's various reasons that that right would disappear. For example, the worker takes another job or something. And as to... it's my understanding back from when family leave was adopted in Oregon, and we adopted ours ahead of the feds, as you know, was that part of it was for the worker's own medical condition. So clearly an injury, whether it was suffered at work or up water skiing on Saturday, the intent of family leave was to provide protection. And again, this stacks the benefit for some workers, but not all.
Any more questions, comments? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and Mr. Sutton.
Folks, you've got your phones on, your Blackberries, your pagers, your car running, whatever it is, shut it off. Please, I beg you. And I'll check mine right now.
Yeah, me too. Good morning. I had a couple of questions for you, Mr. Sutton. I'm not sure whether you specialize in workers' comp or employment law generally.
I specialize in employment law generally and workers' comp with regard to discrimination and the interplay with family leave laws.
Right. So I'm sure you're familiar with the discrimination statutes that we have in Oregon. I don't have them memorized, but somewhere in Chapter 659, it specifies that an injured worker cannot be discriminated against in any term or condition of employment as a result of an on-the-job injury.
Absolutely.
And you have portrayed this as if we're discriminating against everybody else if an injured worker exhausts their entire 12 weeks that everybody else is entitled to under Oregon family leave. And I guess I would put it to you, I see it exactly the opposite. I mean, my scenario, and this actually happened to a constituent of mine, is when somebody is seriously hurt on the job, Oregon's workers' comp statutes call that a no-fault system where the workers hurt through no fault of their own. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to be covered for time loss, for disability, and return to work. They are not supposed to lose their vacation, their sick leave, or in this case, their right to be with a seriously ill family member who may be dying. And the person who contacted my office was off due to a serious on-the-job injury for more than 12 weeks. Finally, luckily for them and their employer, came back to work, was able to go back to work, but had no ability to take time off and had a parent who was dying. So I guess I'm missing something about your argument here about why injured workers who are hurt because of the employer's liability for that on-the-job condition should have no entitlement that every other healthy worker would have to take time off when they have somebody in their family who's dying. And all this bill is meant to remedy, in my view, was a glitch, which I don't think anybody intended to take that right away from people who were hurt on the job. Am I missing something?
The way that the leave works is that you have 12 weeks, and I'm sure you know this, you have 12 weeks, and that can be for any purpose. And there's many situations where a person will need more than 12 weeks. And for public policy reasons, 12 weeks has been the cap. And so whether it's a person's own serious health condition, it could be cancer, it could be an injury on the job or off the job, 12 weeks is the requirement that an employer fulfill. For me, the difficulty with this bill is that essentially it's stacking the leave for only some people, not others. It's stacking the leave for those who are injured at work rather than injured in any other way. I mean, it could be, I could be driving on a weekend and have a car accident. This is equally tragic and equally not my fault. But I'm not covered by workers' comp. I'm only covered by family leave. The point I guess I'm trying to make is family leave law is an additional protection that's designed to protect an employee's job so that they can return to work after an injury. That's exactly what workers' comp does, too. In fact, workers' comp stacks it on a little bit better. It gives time loss benefits and other rights that family leave doesn't even provide. Family leave is unpaid. So they're achieving the same goal, which is to bring the worker back to their old position. And so if we don't run them concurrently, then we're giving an additional family leave right to some employees and not to others. And I guess that's where I was trying to make the point that it's a little unfair.
Well, a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
I guess
the goal of workers' comp is not the same as the goal of family leave, whether in Oregon or federally. The family leave law is there to let people take time off unpaid. That's what the law specified when they have a baby or a family member is seriously ill. or a child, you know, has a need for their parent to be with them during an illness. The workers' comp law, at least the way I always understood it, and Ms. Tressel can correct me if I'm wrong, is there to protect employers and employees, to protect employers from being sued, which they otherwise would be when somebody was hurt at the workplace, and for employees to give them the right to not lose their job, to get some wage replacement, so it is paid leave. And it's not 12 weeks. It's for as long as you're disabled due to that injury, as I'm sure you well know since you're a lawyer. So I guess I don't see the two systems as fulfilling the same purpose, but I think what this bill, you seem to be sort of attributing a lot more than was intended by this bill, which is just to say when somebody's hurt through no fault of their own on the job, they shouldn't lose the right that every other worker has, which is the right to the unpaid leave that's specified in the Oregon Family Leave Act. And that's all the bill's doing. So I guess I don't see, I mean, to me, employers are already tracking separate systems, workers' comp and Oregon Family Leave. They really don't overlap. I mean, they have separate lengths of time. One is paid, the other is unpaid. Mm-hmm. So I guess I just don't see this huge hardship that you're seeing there.
The difficulty for with the Oregon Family Leave Act is it applies to employers with 25 or more employees. And in that size of company, and in most companies here in Oregon, it is difficult to go without an employee for that length of time. And to have an employee who's been gone for an extended period of time and you have held the job open, for them to come back and then to go on another leave of absence, it is a burden. It's a burden on the workers that are carrying the load for that employee, and it's a burden on the employer not being able to hire a replacement for that employee. It adds a lot of uncertainty, and it is difficult for the employers. And there is, I think, a legislative intent that employers should only have so much need to reinstate folks, and then they've got to actually get some business done and have that position be a productive position. So I think there's a policy issue there. The other issue that I'd like the committee to focus on is the administrative burden of this. It is very difficult to balance these laws. I was down in Cape Falls a while back. I did a three-day seminar on how to juggle the Bermuda Triangle of Family Leave laws. It's very difficult to do that. And this is going to add another layer where the federal law is different than the state law, and HR folks are going to be tracking a whole different set of entitlements. So I guess on behalf of the HR profession, I'm asking you to think through that. There's some unintended consequences here, and in my written materials, I've got some information about that, about how eligibility will be calculated when the person comes back. For example, under Oregon Family Leave laws, you have to be working 25 hours per week during the 180-day period before the leave commences. What happens if the person's on comp leave? How does that eligibility calculation work? There's going to be a number of issues that employers are going to have to contend with in dealing with these return-to-work issues.
Does anyone else have any further questions of these nice people? I do have a comment. My wife employs six women. They leave, they have babies, they come back. She doesn't need any laws. She doesn't need anybody's permission, and she just does it. If my little girl... And I'm being straight up honest with you. The odds are stacked against you with me on this bill. My little baby, when she grows up, she gets injured in January. She gets off for a month. She has a baby in December. I want her family leave intact. That's it. And I really appreciate your coming and your testimony. And if anyone else has any more questions, I'll bring up Bill Klutig.
Thank you.
Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
When I read your note first, I thought you said you wanted to speak to me. I said you wanted to speak on the bill. So if my facial expression showed something it shouldn't have, I apologize.
Thank you, Sheriff's Officer. Committee, for the record, my name's Bill, including Carpenters Industrial Council. I have before me here House Bill 2460, and it wound up in two pages. And I'll use this as an illustration. This is our Oregon State Work Comp Laws. And this is the Federal Family Leave Law. Completely different. They were never, ever made to overlap to work on each other. But I can tell you, we have some employers out there that when a person is injured, nobody wants to use workman's comp. Nobody wants to get hurt. Nobody wants to have to use family leave. The intent is two different things. But I can tell you, out in the field, in this state, when a person is injured, when they're signing the paperwork for injury on the job, that somewhere in that paperwork is a family leave paper. A lot of these folks are signing this not knowing that all their rights are covered under workman's comp. Now, most of the time, they never find out that they've lost their family leave. The year expires, everything's fine. But we have many cases where, when they're back to work from their injury and they really need family leave, it's gone. They signed it away. And this will help cure that problem. I urge this committee to forward this to the floor, but it do pass. Thank you.
Any questions of Bill today? Ms. Kluge? Apologize, I had to step out for a minute, but thank you very much for your support. I appreciate it. This is a public hearing. Does anyone else wish to testify on House Bill 2460 today? Ernie Del Mazzio, please.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, my name is Ernie Del Mazzo, Executive Director of Injured Workers Alliance. We're an advocacy group since 1998 for injured workers. I believe we're the only statewide organization. But we support this legislation. Having heard the previous speakers, there was one thing that was omitted, and this is the fact that the accept-deny, their 60-day interval for a claim to be accepted or denied. There's legislation this year that would increase that to 90 days, that we oppose. What if a worker is in that 60 or 90-day interval and they're able to collect family leave and yet their claim is denied? At the same time, you have injured workers who may have accepted claims and may have to fight to get them accepted, and yet when the denial is reversed the very next day, the claim can be denied once again. We support this legislation because we feel that we could have a situation where basically workers are denied both benefits. And I thank you for your time, and I can answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? All right, thanks, Ernie. Does anyone else wish to testify? Yes, sir. Come on up.
Good morning. My name is Ed Johnston, and you can sort of say I'm an expert in workman's comp, especially with Liberty Northwest Insurance Company. I did not get a chance to read this bill, but I know personally what it's like to have an employer, when you are injured on the job, fire you when you go for surgery. And nobody stands up and nobody backs you up when you lose your job on this. I have plenty of documentations on it.
Ed, are you talking about family leave today?
Yes.
Okay.
Because I've tried with family leave because of my family at the time, dealing with that point where I lost my job, I lost my income, and turned out, because of political and the insurance company, I lost my family on it. I've been through federal hearings on it, too, as well. One federal hearing on my disability, which turned out that I was correct. So if this is an improvement for the workers, I support it. And so I'd like to say that. And I have plenty of documentations to back everything I said up. Most of it I've emailed most of you, and it's all factual. Nobody could dispute it. I appreciate your time. And if it's going to improve the workers, pass it, please.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Johnston today? All right. Thank you, sir. Thank you. Would anyone else like to speak to this bill? If not, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2460, open a work session on House Bill 2460. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2460 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum has moved House Bill 2460 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Very good. Kristen, would you call the roll, please? Excuse me.
Aye.
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 Aye. All right, motion carries. Representative Rosenbaum, would you like to carry this on the floor?
I would be very happy to.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Esquivel?
Yes, it says that, at least for the information I've received, it has a physical impact, but the statement is not yet issued.
Mr. Chair, actually, this morning, right before the hearing, the fiscal office sent to me a no fiscal impact statement.
Okay.
There's
Thank
no
you.
Fiscal.
Very good. Thank you for clarifying that, Representative. I'm going to close a work session on House Bill 2460. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2618.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2618 is from Vice Chair Holvey. It prohibits employers from entering into public works contracts for which the contract price exceeds $350,000 unless the employer's approved apprenticeship training agent.
Very good.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holvey.
I move House Bill 2618 to the floor without recommendation as to passage and the bill be referred to the Committee on Workforce and Economic Development.
Any discussion on that motion? Because I'm not going to repeat it.
Honestly.
All right. Very good. Kristen, would you call the roll? Excused.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2618, and I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2240. Lisa?
Yes. House Bill 2240 is pre-session filed on behalf of the Board of State Tax Practitioners. It authorizes the State Board of Tax Practitioners to adopt rules pursuant to the Administrative Procedures Act, and it also increases the maximum amount of fees that may be prescribed by the Board.
Very good. Is there discussion? Is there...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holden.
I move House Bill 2240 to the floor without recommendation as to passage and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Is there discussion on the motion? All right, Kristen, would you call the roll, please? Excuse me.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. All right, then. I'm going to open a... Can you start from the top of the order, Tracy?
Sure.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2435. Tracy, you want to explain?
Yes. House Bill 2435 is introduced by Representative Garrard at the request of the Auto Appraisers of Oregon. It establishes four types of vehicle appraiser certificates, creates qualifications for each of the certificates, and establishes the qualifications that need to be met, and establishes the fees for each of the certificates.
Thank you. I would like to call... I cannot read that name. Monty King and Paul. Paul, I'm sorry, I can't read your last name. Forgive me, I just made it this morning. So, come on up, gentlemen. Monty, if you're ready, go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Monty King. I'm Executive Director of Auto Appraisers of Oregon, also Oregon Vehicle Dealer Association. This House bill is about consumers, about them getting a proper value. I'm going to let Mr. Gustafson talk about that. It's not about car dealers. It doesn't affect car dealers. There haven't been any suggestions for changes of the bills to date. I've talked with many, many parties about it. Most people, when they understand the bill, they don't have a problem with it, what I was just out in the hall with explaining it. I pulled my members, my car dealer members, OVDA members. They have no problem with it. Talk to DMV. There's minimal impact over there. They're not even going to testify is what I was told this morning. So there doesn't seem to be a problem on that front. But the main thing is we've left the car dealers right where they are. We want to make sure that people who want to abandon appraiser vehicle licenses can get those. And that's what a lot of them were for anyway. When local jurisdictions take vehicles off the highway, they need to be able to do that so they can get rid of them fast. So, and I'm going to let Mr. Gustafson talk about the consumer parts of those, of the bill.
Sir? Chairman Schofer, committee members, I'm Paul Gustafson. I'm president of the Auto Appraisers of Oregon. I'm also president of the Oregon Consumer League. I am acting as the Consumer League insurance and auto consultant, and handling the consumer complaints in those two areas. I've been in the car business for over 40 years. I've worn basically every hat in the industry, both wholesale and retail. I have a company called AutoSave AutoSafe, which basically 80% of my business is appraisals. I established AutoSave in 1983 here in Oregon. I come before you because what I've found over the years is that there is a definite need. Let me put it this way. There is no and has been no certification for an auto appraiser nationally that I know of. If I can give you an outline, when a consumer has an automobile that's in an accident and there's an insurance claim against it, one of the things that they're advised to do is to get a certified appraisal. And this is what the insurance adjuster would say in the past, knowing that there is no such thing up until 2 months ago when DMV took the abandoned appraiser certificate here in Oregon and made it an appraiser certificate. So we can boast that Oregon now has a certified appraiser certificate available. In that, though, there's a lot of technical stuff that is involved in being an appraiser. We're not talking about being an 18-minute or 19-minute walk around on a car. I brought some of the tools of the trade with me this morning. I brought some of my files with me. The insurance policies call for a competent, disinterested auto appraiser. Up until 2 months ago, and actually still there's a lot of appraisers out there that aren't aware that they need a license, but up until 2 months ago, anybody could say, I are one, and walk into the industry and charge for an appraisal. I guess I'm coming from the standpoint, Oregon law requires us to have insurance to drive. All the insurance policies, under whether it's uninsured, underinsured coverage, whether it's casualty coverage, there's an arbitration or appraisal clause in it. Even our total loss regulation under the insurance division calls for an appraisal process in it. We need this certification. We need to educate the appraisers that are already in the industry as to the legal ramifications, the arbitration processes, the arbitration law, the insurance law. Now, I have held all the casualty licenses at one time for sale of insurance in the state of Oregon, California, and Alaska. So I'm familiar with that law. I also want to, in this day of privacy laws and privacy concerns, inform you that as an experienced appraiser, if you get into an accident and I get involved, I have almost every piece of information that you would carry as far as, if I'm looking at the receipts on your car, I'm looking at a lot of you pay for your accessories and your car repairs with a credit card. I have your credit card number. I have copies of your signature. I have your Social Security number off the accident reports. I have your driver's license number. That's all available to me. So what I'm saying to you, and the only reason I bring that up, is it's very important that there's a background check done on an appraiser, because this is the type of information they're handling if they're doing their job. And it could be misused. And through the Oregon Consumer League, I see a lot of that complaints for misuse of that type of information. I'm just trying to make the committee aware of that. Let me outline what happens with an accident. You get into an accident with your car, you call your insurance agency, or the insurance agency that's liable, they assign you an adjuster. The adjuster takes a look at your car, calls its equipment level in, et cetera, to two national companies. One is called CCC, the other is called Autotex. Now, it used to be called ADP AutoSource. These two companies are computer data banks that gather the retail prices and the wholesale prices on cars out of, say, the Oregonian classifieds, the Auto Truck Trader, et cetera. The insurance companies use these two companies to value the car that's lost or totaled. Okay, and at that point, they send the consumer a nice 15, 17, 20-page report with supposedly comparable cars on it. Either the insurance company or the consumer at that time, if they disagree with value, can impose the appraisal or enact the appraisal clause in their policies, whether it's under the uninsured, underinsured coverages or under the casualty portion, comprehensive collision. At that point, the appraisal clause basically says this: if you disagree with us being the insurance company, over value, you must hire a competent, disinterested appraiser. The insurance company must do the same. If the two appraisers agree on a value, that's what you get. If they don't agree, the two appraisers, not the insurance company and not the owner of the car, must select a third appraiser to act as an umpire in the matter. Whatever two out of the three appraisers in the matter agree to, that's what the consumer or the owner of the vehicle gets. That settles the matter. Okay. The problem is if the two appraisers can't agree on value, what makes anybody think they can agree on who the third is going to be? That's one of the big hassles, okay? And if that happens, and some of the insurance policies and their border plate appraisal clause don't carry it far enough. In other words, they don't. An arbitration clause, as far as I'm concerned, should be the roadmap to finishing the whole problem or taking care of the problem. But most of the, like in State Farm, for instance, and I'm picking, use them, but they carry it that far. They don't say what the two appraisers should do after that. Well, then it kicks in, what they should do is it kicks into the rules of arbitration. I, as the owner of the vehicle's appraiser, will then go to the presiding judge in the county where the insured lives and set before that presiding judge a list of competent, disinterested appraisers to act as the umpire. The insurance appraiser has the same right, okay? The problem there, and that we're running into, is the only judge, and he's now deceased in the state of Oregon, was Judge Launder in Multnomah County that understood the process. If I go into Washington County, Marion County, whatever, to the presiding judge, they end up calling the insurance division and talking to the compliance officer to see if they have the right to select the third. So it's a real hassle. What I propose through this, and we're working toward it, is if this passes, we would end up with a master appraiser's license, which would be on a list before the judge in all the counties, and the judge could then select off that list for that person, that appraiser, to become, or one of the master appraisers, to become the umpire in the matter. It would take care of the whole problem that I fight as an appraiser on a daily basis. If an education process is in to groom a master appraiser, certify a master appraiser, and then put it before a presiding judge. There's it's a very complex situation. It's not, as again, it's not just an 18-minute eyeball of the car and say, oh, I think it's worth this. There's a lot of research involved. Coming up prices, we're talking about, in some cases, a special interest car. I looked at a 1968 Dodge Charger the other day that basically looked like a Charger, smelled like a Charger, but it was ground up, rebuilt from and modified into a hot rod special interest class, and the person spent over $357,000 on it. And it took national awards and was published in front of on a hot rod magazine. I'm just saying that there's a wide gambit, and we might be talking about a $2,000 car. We might be talking about something like this Charger at $350,000. So we're not playing with small dollars here. It costs the average consumer to go through the process now about $850 if they're going to argue with the insurance company over value. And I sit also as a consumer representative on Oregon Dealer Advisory Committee, I also sit on the insurance division as a consumer advocate. And the last, right now, the insurance division is looking at changing the total loss regulation so that the insurance companies have to pay the cost of that appraiser. That's not law yet. It's just something they're considering changing this year, this session. I hope it goes through because it is a big burden on the consumer. I think I've said enough.
Okay. Any questions? Ladies and gentlemen, Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if this question should be directed at these gentlemen or others, but from, if I understand your testimony, we had no such thing as a certified auto appraiser at this time. We don't.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, right now, a little bit of history. A number of years ago, the law was passed about an auto appraiser license, and somehow it got converted into a abandoned vehicle appraiser license. But the law actually didn't say there was supposed to be an abandoned appraiser license issued. It just said a person who had such a license could appraise abandoned vehicles. Okay. So when this was discovered last fall, DMV went on a process of changing their rules to change their abandoned vehicle appraiser license to a vehicle appraiser license. And that's basically what we have now. And that is the second one of these four that are in the bill. So what we've added with the bill is a abandoned vehicle appraiser license, continued the appraiser license as it is now, and then created two classes above that that require education to be a certified vehicle appraiser and a master certified. And that education would be done by a provider that would be approved by the Oregon Dealer Advisory Committee. So there is one. There is no requirement, however, that anybody have an appraiser license to appraise a vehicle. So if you want to say, I am a licensed vehicle appraiser, now you got to have a license if you want to be able to say that in advertising. I've seen advertising by Hertz, for instance, down here. And they were advertising they had certified vehicle appraisers or licensed certified vehicle appraisers in their advertisement. Of course, it wasn't true because there weren't any. Okay, but the we have them. They don't mean a lot, and any vehicle dealer out on the lot can do an appraisal, either for somebody driving by, what's my car worth? They can still do that. They can put it on their letterhead, but if they don't have an appraiser license, they can't say I'm an appraiser licensed appraiser. With the bill, they couldn't say I'm a certified master or anything else like that, but they could still appraise cars, and they can still give values for cars on the lot for trade-ins or anything else. So I say this vehicle does not affect in any way any vehicle dealer who's licensed now.
Mr. Chair.
Would you like to address her question, her first question?
Well, I haven't gotten to my question yet.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead, Representative.
My question is, clearly, the waters are muddy as to who and what appraises vehicles, and I'm really concerned that by creating four categories, you have muddied the water further for the consumer rather than made it easier. If you're developing a somebody who has this certification, I mean, yeah, every time you walk on a lot, oh yeah, I can appraise cars, and you know, as a consumer, I go, oh yeah, yeah, and you can sell me one too. So I think what you're trying to do, which I'm with you on, by the way, is some sort of a standard that as a consumer I can say this person has these trainings and can do these things for me and is independent and can work with insurance. I mean, somebody who's real, and I applaud that, but by making vehicle appraiser certificate, certified vehicle appraiser, master vehicle certified, you're muddying the water instead of clearing it for the consumer. So I'm trying to read this bill and understand the difference as I'm sitting here listening to your testimony, and I don't get there. And so I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm suggesting that maybe there's a little more work here.
Representative, my wife didn't take 18 minutes. She took 18 seconds to appraise my old Chevy pickup. That's why I had to get rid of it.
Yeah, I understand that. So I'm not against you. I'm just trying to say that I think you're making something bigger or more complicated when something simpler would do. And I also, I kind of think two-year re-up is, I don't know, it seems like short to me. If you've gone through this training, I don't know. I don't know enough about appraising cars, I'll admit that.
Do you gentlemen want to address the representative's concerns, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, that is the first suggestion anybody has made for a change, and we have talked about changes, and we are willing to work with anybody about making it simpler I talked with Paul about it, and he can answer for himself. We want to make sure that for the certified type of people, there's some required training by some organization, not DMV, to actually give them a valuable training type of certificate. Okay. As far as abandoned vehicle appraiser or regular appraiser, we can take out the abandoned if they want, and we can take out the certified or the certified. We'd rather stay with the master certified. But yeah, we're willing to work with anybody on an amendment to make it simpler. I think your points are well taken. And
well, I agree with Monty. As far as the abandoned certificate, if they have the regular certificate now, just regular, they can do that. And that's for tow truck drivers, et cetera, to set a value on a vehicle for public entity. If the one thing that I would like to see is that we have a certified appraiser and we have a master's appraiser. Master appraisers for the judge, et cetera, for the judicial system to use. As far as the car dealers go, they have a dealer's license. If I, as a dealer, which I have been, walk into a court of law and testify as to it, there isn't a jury in the world or a judge that's going to discredit my testimony if I hold a dealer's license and I have the experience. So it doesn't affect dealers. We're just talking about a person that says, I'm an appraiser.
Yes. Thank you. I appreciate it. In my own mind, I'm thinking about Vice Chair Esquivel's profession, where you can get an appraisal on your house from any realtor coming or going, but when you really want an independent look, you go to a real estate appraiser who is independent. And I think that's what you're trying to get to here, right? Is that thing, and I'm with you on that. I just think it's a little too confusing here the way it's currently written.
Just for the record, we don't appraise houses. We do a comparative market analysis.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, that's right. I'm sorry.
It's going to cost you if you do an appraisal.
Yeah, right.
Ever.
And there's a reason, I think, Mr. Chair, that you had to go to that, was because of confusion in the marketplace with appraisers who are independent and trained to be. So I think that it speaks to just what I'm talking about. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Representative Berger. We would be willing to work with you and maybe the chair and anybody else who wants to work with us for an amendment on the bill. I did talk with the tow association out in the hallway, and they're willing to work with anybody on that too. They don't have any problems with the bill with the four or the two either way. So, nobody else has come to us with any real concerns as yet. So, we will work with you on that.
Representative Holby, are you finished, Representative Berger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I share Representative Berger's concern with the confusion of all the different types of certificates, I guess. I think it could be a lot more simplified. But actually, I've got sort of a unconnected question. I'm curious, in your testimony, you said you were able to obtain private documents that included Social Security numbers, and sort of caught my interest. I'm wondering where do you get documents, and who gives them to you that have Social Security numbers on them?
Actually, the consumer, the owner of the vehicle. When you go to them and you ask for the reports, et cetera, on the vehicle, it could come through an attorney on the paperwork if the attorney hires you. It could come from, it could be on some insurance paperwork that you're privy to or you're given. I do have some of my files here, and I can't give them to you as evidence because they're working files. I need them back in my office, but I can show you the type of information that I have that's involved with that. You're more than welcome to look at that.
So basically, you're telling me that the consumer is the one that's giving you the Social Security numbers?
Consumer or the attorney or some insurance companies on their
insurance
paperwork.
Companies as well. Huh?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum, please.
Thanks. Money, who puts on the training that's called for in this bill? Is it training that exists now, or is it something that would have to be created?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, we, the association, has given training. There's been a four-hour class. I went through it myself. Really neat. and a lot of stuff I didn't know, even though I've been in the business for 20 years. So there is a provider now, but under the bill, any organization could start their own school. So the new car dealers could start their own school, a college could start a school, an appraiser could start their own school, any car association. So that's open. They just need to apply to the Oregon Dealer Advisory Committee, show that they have a good program and what the content of it is, and then the Oregon Dealer Advisory Committee would approve that. Once they were approved, then with the application to DMV Business Regulation for a certified appraiser license or master certified, they would have to show that certificate of completed education. Basically, the exact same process is in the pre-licensing school for dealers, which has been in effect since January 1st, 2000, which is an 8-hour class. So same process, basically same approval process.
So follow up, Mr. Chair. So is this a lucrative opportunity for whoever provides this training then? I mean, do you charge money to go to it, or is it free?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, it's not lucrative. It's hopefully to break even, but it's not going to be lucrative. There just aren't the numbers of auto appraisers like there are auto dealers. I have a, you know, OBDA has a state-licensed pre-licensing school. There's a lot of costs involved. It's not that lucrative, but it's a good part of the association as far as contacts and my knowing stuff and doing it. And I have to do the classes myself. I am not going to be doing these classes. These classes are going to be given by people like Paul, who really know what they're doing. I'm the association director. All I'm going to do is manage the paperwork and the process, and I'm going to make very, very little out of it. I've been executive director, so I haven't taken a cent now in, what, a year?
Yeah.
So.
Nor have I.
Yeah. So there's been no money coming in. There's been no payroll, no nothing. This is a low-dollar effort by a group of people who really want to see their industry improve. So it's not lucrative.
I guess what I was asking is typically would somebody wants to become a certified appraiser under this bill, would they have to pay out of pocket to attend this training? And if so, how much would that cost them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, right now it would be $200 for the master certified program. And that's an 8-hour class. If they are, the way we've done it is if they're a member of our association, they get $100 off. But it also makes them a member of the auto appraisers for a year also. So there's a couple benefits there. Membership in the association is $200 a year. So it's very small compared to what it can do for somebody. That's my opinion.
Well, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, I guess. Who appoints the Oregon Dealer Advisory Committee? Is that a state committee, or exactly who sanctions that committee?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holby, Oregon Dealer Advisory Committee is put together out of the Oregon Administrative Rules, Chapter 150, 735-150. Okay, and it's like right away in that section. It's authorized under ORS Chapter 822. I don't have the exact number. It is a committee composed of 11, 12, something like that, people appointed by the DMV Deputy Administrator, Lorna Youngs, two used vehicle dealers, two representative used car dealers, two representatives of new car dealers, a tow operator, two consumer representatives, a person who does paperwork for car dealers, an RV dealer, and there's a couple more.
Thank you. Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I'm, don't want to beleaguer this point too much, but so this advisory committee and this training that you're going to provide, and this is somewhat state sanctioned, and you're going to have a a different price for somebody who belongs to a particular association for obtaining this training or taking the test as such to the general public. You know, I really question the policy, you know, of that. Really, I'm not sure I'm just not sure that that's a good policy, that we're going to charge people a different price based on whether they belong to your particular association as opposed to somebody who is just wanting to get into this business from some other organization or some other, or say Sal Esquivel, for example, might want to get into this type of market analysis and or appraisal, and he doesn't belong to your association. And so you're going to charge him $100 more to take that test. I'm not sure I agree with that. But do you have a comment about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holley, DMV isn't charging anything. So nothing, you know, DMV is only going to see the final certificate. If somebody wants to be a member of our association, our dues are $200 a year. If they wanted to go in and do the class, that's $200, but you get $100 off. That's the association policy. That has nothing to do with DMV. DMV is out of that loop. So they're actually going to pay $100 less, and that's good for them if they want to be a association member also. If the association doesn't want to do that, the leadership doesn't want to do that, you know, they don't have to do that. I don't see any problem with it. Everybody gives discounts on one thing or another, rebates on cars, grocery stuff. It's the manufacturer, the product, that has to give the rebate.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Sure. And maybe you cleared that up for me. So an individual that wants to take a test to become a dealer isn't required to have the education or training from your particular program.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holby, are you talking about dealer pre-licensing?
No, I'm talking about this certificate for the appraisal.
Okay.
You're requiring education of some sort and training in the statutes or in this bill to get that. So do they have to get it from your training, as you're the training provider for that, your association is? Can they get it someplace else, I guess?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, right now, for dealer pre-licensing, there are three providers.
Let's do these for sure.
And I've heard rumors of other people who want to have a school. There's no limit to the number of schools, as far as I know, who can do that pre-licensing for dealers.
I'm talking about the training for this appraisal certificate,
right,
for dealers.
Right, but it's the same approval process. If this bill passes, then we are going to apply to the Oregon Dealer Advisory Committee for approval of our training program. Anybody else can do the same thing.
Ronnie, we got to get going.
Thank you.
We have some other things to do. So I'm just, if people have more questions, I encourage them to call you or any of the good people. But we have an agenda I want to get through. I apologize.
No,
we're out of here at 10:45 today, so we're under the gun.
Sorry.
Thank you very much. That's quite all right, Representative. Don't worry about it. thank you, sir. I'm going to call Daryl Fuller, Gary Peterson, and Don Lule. I hope I've said that right. Yeah. Gentlemen, just start right off. Whoever wants to go first.
Mr. Chair and Committee, my name is Don Newley. I've been a car dealer for 25 years and an appraiser for about 20 years. First off, we're in a little bit of opposition of the way the bill is read. Representative Berger, you pretty much hit exactly our take on it. We need to spend some more time on this. We can simplify it a whole bunch. It's kind of interesting. It's not like there's a whole line of people standing in line that want to be a used car or an automobile appraiser. I appraise, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cars a year under the license that I have. When I obtained that license several years ago, it's not like anybody can just go down and get a license. It's through DMV. I had to get a letter of recommendation from someone that was qualified, that was already had a license, which Mr. Peterson is with us today, gave me that letter of recommendation, and a letter, and I had to put a statement together of my qualifications. So again, it's something could be simplified. We need to have some kind of regulation, but not near what I see here today. But again, I try to emphasize, not anybody can go down and get this license, and I guarantee you there's not people standing in line that want to go become a licensed appraiser. We're making it like, you know, there's a lot more real estate appraisers out there than what automobile appraisers will ever be. I've done a lot of testifying for court systems, insurance companies, replacement values, every imaginable thing involved with automobiles, I've done it. And it seems to work. The certification that I have has been asked for me numerous times. It's either if you don't have it, you can't appraise an automobile. So again, to simplify what we have, we just need to spend some more time as a group and try to come up with some kind of simple program. And I think we're there. We just got to clean it up. We don't believe that we need this many certifications. You know, just to be able to have a license to appraise automobiles would be simple enough. How we get that is another question. I can't imagine me walking into a classroom in 4 hours to do 25 years of experience that I've done. Mr. Peterson, of 40 years. I spoke to another appraiser last night that's been doing it for 33 years. So we got 100 years of experience here to go into a classroom and get 4 hours of class, spend 4 hours to get this master certification. I'm still learning every day. I cannot imagine how I could go in and learn all the trades of all the secrets of the trade in 4 hours. Either you've got it or you don't. You know, maybe we can grandfather in existing appraisers if you've got 10 or 15 or 20 years of experience, but simplification is we just need to work on a little bit more.
Mr. Peterson?
Yeah, I recognize the chair. I'm not sure I
can identify yourself.
Gary Peterson, I'm sorry.
Yeah. That's quite right.
I'm not so sure that this isn't a good idea to have certification, but at my time, I probably was the only appraiser in the state of Oregon. And originally, the license, for what it was, the abandoned license, was something that we dreamed up. And it wasn't anything that really needed, except I had the state contract at the time to appraise all the abandoned drug seized vehicles, and I needed something in order to do that. So that license that we have today really doesn't have a lot of clout. But I guess Monty and Paul have a good idea. Basically, I've never been in a courtroom with Paul, and I've never been up against him in an arbitration hearing of any sort. So I don't know really his complete background. I know that Monty's has nothing to do with the appraisal business whatsoever. He's basically a lobbyist. But it's a business that we're entrusted in, and State Farm and some of the large insurance companies, when we stand up for them and say, yes, that vehicle is worth X amount of dollars, we mean it. We have reasons for that, and we can back it up. Just to get a license in 4, 5, 6 hours and be called a master appraiser or certified appraiser doesn't really make any sense to me. But Don Lule was one that I did mentor and believe in wholeheartedly, and he does a wonderful job. I get calls every day from different attorneys trying to put me in a courtroom to stand up against another attorney on a divorce hearing or whatever pertaining to cars, vintage cars or specialty cars of some sort. And I try not to do that. That's not something I really want to do. And it doesn't happen too often, but Mr. Gustafson makes a living at that. That's basically what he does. He goes and gets into more of the legal aspects of what's going on. So the reason I'm here is just to say, you know, it's okay with me if this particular person is qualified, but I've been a new car dealer, past auto auction owner, dealer auctions, 2 times a new car dealer. I have the credentials, and I had to earn them. And it's important to me not to just certify anybody and call them a master appraiser. I would say, yes, I am the master appraiser, but I don't sign anything as that. I'm just what I am. And if you want to ask me what I do, I can tell you. So.
Did my wife call you about my abandoned Chevy pickup?
Yeah, she did.
I'm sure you're eminently qualified. Representative Esperon, please.
Well, Mike threw out a suggestion, and it relates to my particular profession, that when you first become a broker, you have to spend at least 3 years under the supervision of a principal broker before you can even apply to become a principal broker. So maybe you want to work in some time frames for on the job, because the one thing I learned very adamantly is when you go to real estate school, they teach you the laws, they just don't teach you how to be a realtor. So I would suggest that maybe you guys could get together and work it out. I think there's some possibilities here.
Mr. Fuller, would you like to speak to this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller, representing the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. I am a master certified lobbyist, but it is as yet an unlicensed profession. And in the brevity of time, I will just simply indicate that we think Mr. King and Mr. Gustafson have correctly identified a problem, and we look forward to working with them and hopefully finding a solution that everybody can bring back and support.
Great. Any questions of these gentlemen? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Larry Nelson and Gary Vandermeer, please. Come on, please. Thank you very much. Please identify yourself for the record, sir, and then go right ahead.
My name is Larry Nielsen. I currently have a company known as Big Block, and we appraise vehicles. Mr. Gustafson mentioned that the largest appraisers in the state of Oregon are two companies, Certified Collateral Corporation, CCC, and now Auditex. Auditex Corporation was recently purchased, and it was previously owned by a company called ADP. ADP purchased a company in 1992 from myself and my partner called National Auto Data Service. At that time, that company, National Auto Data Service, was appraising approximately 400 cars a day through a computerized system. Currently, ADP or Auditex probably does 5,000 cars a day through an automated computerized system. I believe I understand the appraisal business. And this system is odd in that there are so few actual appraisers out there, and the system didn't identify or address the computer. Does the computer have to have a license? Does each insurance adjuster have to have a license? There's a bunch of questions about this. Who has to be licensed? But as far as appraisers in this state, I would suspect there's less than 20 full-time appraisers. Many times the appraisers in this state are supplement their income by doing appraisals once in a while. I don't know of any appraising companies in this state that have employees apart from the current company I own. I don't see it as a source of state revenue. I see it as a negative cost for the to administrate it because there's so few numbers. And then the next question is, once a person is certified through this system, will it make them a better appraiser? We all know, perhaps we know, construction people who have licenses and are certified in by the state, and they still do lousy construction work. Right. So how is this system going to improve the appraisal process? And if there is a license to be an appraiser, should there not be a bond attached to it so that the appraiser puts his money where his mouth is? And another question that this didn't deal with is, what about all the internet appraisers out of state that do appraisals in this state? Does not address them. I feel that the whole exercise is a waste of everybody's time. I think it's self-policing at the moment. If you can gain customers in a normal business manner, then go out and do it. And if you have the mental capability of an appraising a vehicle, then do it. It's a free world. The last thing is, if I, as a company that appraises vehicles, and because of this system, is if I'm compelled to take a class, and the class is taught by one of my competitors, isn't that something to do with an unfair trade practice? So my opinion is this whole thing is just a waste of time.
Any questions of Mr. Nelson? I really appreciate your testimony and all the testimony. There's a lot of concerns with this bill. The nice people that sponsored this bill said we need to have a conversation, and that's what we're having. And so don't you eminently qualified business people get too worried about anything around here. The conversation will continue. We ain't going to do anything to harm anybody's business, I can assure you that, or make you feel uncomfortable or give your competitors unfair advantages or anything of that nature, I assure you. So anyone else like to ask any questions for Mr. Nelson? Anyone else like to testify to House Bill 2435? I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2435. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2437. And I just will forewarn the testifiers today. We are out of here in a half an hour. And so let's be concise and get our jobs done in a timely fashion. Monty King, Daryl Fuller, Larry Nelson. Get you all up here at once. I should have Mr. Nelson stay up here. Mr. Nelson, you want to come testify to this one? We've got you on the list here, too. Come on up. There's only three folks. You can all sit up here and arm wrestle together. Or not.
My name is Monty King, Oregon Vehicle Dealer Association. Mr. Chairman, are we on
2437. Wait. Is that what I said?
Yes.
That's the public hearing on House Bill 2437.
Thank you. So the record, my name is Monty King, President of Oregon Vehicle Dealer Association. There's a little glitch in the law that passed in 1999, and basically nothing was said about how long a certificate is good for once it's issued by a pre-licensing school. And we'd like to limit that so they can't get a license and then go out of being a license and then 10 years later come back and use the same certificate to get another license without having to do any education during that period of time. The concept was, while you're a dealer, you're doing continuing education continually to be able to relicense. So we wanted to limit how long that initial 8-hour school certificate was good for. We drafted the bill at 3 years. We've had a request that we go to a 1-year certificate. We don't really have a problem with that, and we can probably work that out. Mr. Fuller, that was their request. We go to a 1-year limit on the certificate. So as long as they used it within a year to get a license, then it was good. They waited longer than a year, they'd have to go to school again. So we're going to do that.
All right. Mr. Nelson, please.
I just, I was under the impression that this particular portion was also related to the previous, and it appears that it isn't. So I was saying.
That's okay. We're trying to figure it out, too. So thank you. Daryl?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller with the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. Again, Mr. King has correctly identified a problem. You have to get pre-licensing education to be licensed as a vehicle dealer. The way the law is currently constructed, once you've gone through that 8-hour class, your pre-licensing certificate is good for infinity. And we tend to think that probably the industry changes over time and that perhaps that certificate ought to have an expiration date. And we believe that 1 year is probably relevant. And Mr. King has agreed with us. So we hope to bring the bill back with an amendment and without opposition.
Great. Thanks. Any questions from you?
Yeah, I do. I'm a little confused, gentlemen, if you'll help me here. You go through 8 hours of tests to get your dealer's license, right? And right now, that means you have your license after you've taken it, or you're not issued a certificate. I guess, is it 3 years? Are you saying that every year you have to renew? And I'm concerned that that's what you're saying, because I don't think that's what we want. Mm. So what you're saying is you have to actually get the certificate within 1 year of doing the training. or something.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, that is correct. The education certificate allows you to apply for a dealer's license.
So you're saying that you want, within 1 year, you want you to actually get that license?
Right. And if they don't, then they're going to have to redo it.
Okay.
The dealer license itself is a 3-year license.
Oh, okay. Got it.
You go to school, you get your certificate, then you go apply for your license. You got 1 year to get your license after you get your certificate. You don't, you got to go back to school. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. And then there is continuing education to renew that license, but not that many hours. It's a certain number of hours per year, so that when you renew your license in 3 years, you also have to have certified that you've taken the continuing education. But the pre-licensing education is more, and that's prior to your first application. And then they have to keep up with the continuing education to maintain their license.
So, Mr. Chair, they'll come back with an amendment that makes it at 1 year, and we're all happy. Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Would anyone else like to testify to House Bill 2437 today? Okay, Monty and Daryl, you might as well stand up here. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2437. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2438. Gentlemen?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Monty King, President of Oregon Vehicle Dealer Association. We have -2 amendments being handed out. I want to start out by saying the amendments take out any conversation or any change to the bond. So the bond thing is completely out of here. The last section of the bill was talking about an exemption from dealer licensing for certain mechanical types of repair for people. The amendments take that out. So all we are left with is a form that is now required for each dealer to give a consumer who buys a vehicle that had been consigned to the dealer. The amendment basically says, the current form basically says, hey, consumer, this vehicle is being was consigned to the dealer. This person has consigned the vehicle. And that person who designed the vehicle has a lien at such and such financial institution. Well, dealers don't believe they should have to give out the name of the previous owner because that's non-public personal information. And we don't believe we should have to give out the name of their bank. Besides, what can they do with the name of the bank? The bank's not going to give them any information. So it's not useful information, and it's non-public personal information. Normally it has to be shielded from anybody else. We've talked with the Department of Justice. They have signed off on the -2 amendments. This morning, the Banking Association Financial Institutions came back and said that they would like one further change. They would like a check mark on it to say if there is or is not a lien on the vehicle. I'm not saying tell them who the bank is or anything, just there is a lien on it, so you need to make sure that this dealer gets it paid off. And we have no problem with that. That's one thing we want to make sure, too. And consignment laws are a lot different than regular laws on when vehicles are paid off. Dealers on a consignment has 10 days to satisfy all the interests on that vehicle when they sell the vehicle to a consumer.
Money on that one right there. Your bill, the original bill, is deleting the disclosure. You're just leaving it in.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. But we are taking in the -2 amendments on page 2.
Okay.
You can see inside that form, you can see within the bracket of the amount.
Yes, sir.
It's taken out. Who the title of the vehicle is in and the name of the lien holder. So with the -3 amendments that we'll have drafted at the request of the financial institutions, okay, we'll have a,
right,
there is a lien or not a lien.
Daryl.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller for the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. This is one of many skirmishes in the battle between consumer protection versus privacy rights in terms of what kind of information gets distributed. Not too awfully long ago, the back of a vehicle title had 6 or 7 different reassignments. You could find out the last 5 or 6 people that owned a car and their address. And, you know, if you want to get a vehicle history, it was a great way to take the phone book and start calling people. We've changed that now to a single reassignment simply because of privacy concerns, and dealers are concerned about their exposure in providing too much information on behalf of previous owners of vehicles. So again, this is a lot of work in working with the Department of Justice and consumer groups and the dealers to make sure that enough information is provided to the purchaser of a consigned vehicle, but that we don't overexpose previous owners. And with the changes that are requested by the financial institution, I think it'd be a good bill.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, DMV also has signed off on it.
Great, very good. This one seems a little easier.
Oh, no, Mr. Chair. See, the way it works is this. Instead of having you're looking at a used car, and instead of calling all the previous owners, you call an appraiser.
Certified. Any questions for these fine gentlemen? All right, thank you, guys.
Mr. Chairman, we still have 20 minutes.
Yeah, and we're going to use them wisely, Mr. King. Would anyone else like to testify to House Bill 2438?
You might have
20
more minutes.
If not, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2438. I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2435. Mr. Vandermeer drove up from Eugene today, and he'd like to testify. Thank you. Just identify yourself for the record and take care of business.
First of all, I want to introduce myself. I'm Gary Vandermeer. I'm an independent auto appraiser with Vandercraft Resources in Eugene, and serving Lane County and all of the state of Oregon. I want to thank the chairman very much for his consideration. I can say I only learned of this proposed legislation yesterday. I'm sorry for my tardiness. I had to juggle my schedule to make time to come up here, and quite frankly, not being familiar with the center of Salem and the parking arrangements here, I've spent a few minutes circling the building.
Well, if legislators can find it, I'm confident you could.
Well, with time, all things are possible. Basically, let me state that I have a dog in this fight. Primarily what I do is work as a consumer representative. I'm a consumer advocate in most situations, though I work for a variety of different entities in doing appraisals. In addition to consumers, I also work for banks, attorneys, credit unions. I've done expert testimony in a variety of different situations. But my concern here is this, is basically the unfairness to the consumer of this proposed legislation. In looking at this, I have to say, is anyone on this panel familiar with the normal insurance valuation process?
Nope, I'm not.
If I could offer a nutshell, then, essentially, if your vehicle is involved in an accident, what the insurance company does is they send out an adjuster to take a look at the vehicle. The adjuster makes note of name, rank, serial number, features, options, general condition of the vehicle, and then that information is relayed to a third party to get a value on that vehicle. That information is then relayed back to the adjuster or to another adjuster who may be out of state. That person then tries to negotiate a settlement with the consumer. We're looking at a situation here where there is going to be no obligation under this proposed legislation, where the same threshold that the consumer's representative is going to have to attain is not mandated upon the insurance industry. You're looking at a situation where someone who has never seen the vehicle, never laid eyes on it, has no idea of the history of the vehicle, if it's a one owner, if it's something that has a new transmission in it, that information is never required for them to do their evaluation of the vehicle's value. As an independent appraiser, we're in a position to come forward, represent the consumer, give them a chance to have their say in either arbitration under their insurance policy or in going to court. If the same criteria is applied to the insurance industry that will be mandated for independent appraisers under this proposed bill, you're going to be looking at a situation where the insurance industry is going to come down here in numbers that will fill this room to overflowing. That cost for them having to meet the same standard as consumers are going to be mandated in doing is going to mean additional costs to the insured, whether you ever have to do this or not. The opportunity for the small consumer to have their day in court, if you will, in fairness, is going to be decreased because of the additional costs that we're going to have to bear and pass on to them. Folks, I am doing this kind of off the top of my head, so I hope you'll bear with me. I have a dog in this fight, like I say. I know that there's a lot of people who don't have the option of spending a lot of money to protect their interests. We have a situation where we have insurance company adjusters who are making these decisions. There is no mandate that they meet the same criteria. You have a situation where, as an independent, I'm going to have to pass those costs on to the consumers. There's a barrier to fairness here in resolution and increased costs. That means that there's going to be fewer adjusters that are available to the public because there's people who, because of the costs, aren't going to be able to do this. If you impose the same standard on the insurance industry that you're imposing on us, those costs are going to increase on the average consumer, and that means higher premiums to every single consumer in the state. Under this proposed legislation, currently there is every single law enforcement entity in the state that has someone who goes out and picks up wrecked or vehicles or carcasses along the side of the road, they're going to have to now be included in this program as well. And I don't know about the rest of the state, but I know in Lane County, with the loss of funding that's coming to have the additional burden of having to sponsor someone from the city and from the county to go out, take this training, and then come back and represent them is going to be something that is a burden that the county is not going to be in a position to bear well. Folks, I will be glad to present additional information later, and I would be glad to speak with each and every one of you, but I can only strongly urge you to look at this and say this is a solution in search of a problem. This is something that is not going to work as it's proposed to the benefit of the citizens of the state of Oregon, and it is certainly not going to benefit consumers in terms of being able to get fairness and trying to get a reasonable resolution of an auto claim.
Thank you, Mr. Vandermeer. You didn't have the benefit of the testimony when you were in the initial hearing. There's a lot of people, a lot of nice people have concerns. I would urge you to exchange your contact information with the proponents and the opponents and the legislature, and we'll just...
Mr. Chairman, could you point
we're,
that out?
We're Monty King and Mr. Gustin right there, and so...
Are they proponents or opponents?
They're proponents. This concept has a lot of work. Monty, we don't need to talk anymore. I'm going to close the public hearing because we're running out of time, but that's... I really appreciate you coming up here. I think a lot of people share your concerns, so I'm gonna.
Again, Mr. Chairman, I thank the committee for its indulgence, and again, I'm passionate about this because the people that I represent are not going to be well served.
Abundantly clear, sir. You've made your case there.
Thank you.
I'm gonna close the public hearing on House Bill 2435, and we have some
committee
bills to introduce.
Okay, you just need to open up a work session.
Okay, Representative. Oh, I'm going to open a work session to introduce committee bills. Representative Holvey.
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 2437, LC 2862, LC 2946, LC 3030, and LC 3696 be introduced as committee bills.
Representative Holvey is in, moves that LCs 2437, 2862. 2946, 3030, 3696.
We already did the public hearing.
Oh, no, they were doing LCs, Representative Smith.
Be introduced as...
They're in 2437, though.
Committee bills.
We have 2436.
Excuse me, it is 2436.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Strike 2437 and enter 2436. Is there discussion? And once again, I'll remind the committee that you're in no way, shape, or form entitled to vote for or against this, these bills. We're just introducing them. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? So moved. I'm going to close the work session, and we stand adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.